Technology.ie. It's Monday, May 4th, 2015.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
My name is Conor Muinichon and you're welcome to the show. Today we bring you an extended interview recorded with Detective Garda Mick Moran. He's a member of An Garda Síochána, but for the last 8 years he has worked with Interpol, based in Lyon in France, in the area of human trafficking and child exploitation. Now, as a result of this, he has a particular interest in technology, in the internet and in internet governance, which has led to him getting to know our CEO here at Black Knight, that's Michaela Nealon, at various international events. Recently, when Mick was home on holidays in Ireland, he called in to see us at the Black Knight office in Carlow, and I sat down to have a chat with him. We've already published a video excerpt from that interview online at technology.ie. This is the full extended interview you're about to hear. It's about a half an hour long, and Mick goes into a great deal of detail in relation to child protection and the role of technology and technology practitioners in protecting children online. I began by asking him about his role in Interpol.
In Lyon, I'm the assistant director in charge of human trafficking and child exploitation, the HTCE subdirectorate. So I have worked there for the last 8 years. I am a member of An Garda Síochána. I've worked with Interpol in Lyon for the last 8 years on loan. So the Minister for Justice in Ireland basically signs me off to Interpol. So I work there for my bosses in Australian, and while on my team I'd have a lad from Israel, I'd have a fella, a couple of American, French, a girl from Benin, and I have a lad from Ivory Coast. So you can see it's quite spread out around the world. A lad from Chile, a very good guy from Chile, on the team. And
how does Interpol work, Mick? I mean, you liaise between police forces and different jurisdictions.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, Hollywood would have you believe that we hop out of helicopters and we rescue the damsel in distress. But the reality of it, the reality of Interpol is it's the International Criminal Police Association. So it's an international organisation pulled together by constitution. And the most important article in that constitution would be Article 3, which means that there'd be no... Our services or our databases or anything like that, our tools and services would not be used for any reason, military, religious, politically, and there's another one there for racist reasons.
Yeah.
So any of those reasons, it can't be used. So basically, it's about criminal police. And criminal police in a country, generally speaking, when a country is running well, the criminal police operate on a different level than your political police might, or your internal security or your external security police. The criminal police, their job is crime. Their job is public safety. Their job is ultimately not associated with whether the country lives or dies. It's about just solving crime.
So, as such, it's an area where nations and governments can find common ground and all agree on matters of public safety.
Absolutely.
And criminal.
You have it hit the nail on the head there. And our job, really, is to get criminal police organisations in these countries to talk to each other. Mm. Right? To get them moving. And we celebrated 100 years of the inaugural meeting last year. Basically, investigators from around the world came together in Monaco and said, right, lads, how can we make this a little bit better? And of course, as during the 19th century and early 20th century, as wealth increased and as travel increased, so too did criminality cross borders increase. And so the idea was just basically that there be an exchange of information. And, you know, people must understand that in the international environment, say, for example, if I want to present evidence of a crime that happened here in Ireland in a court in Austria, there's a huge judicial process to be gone through to make that happen. That's the judicial channel. To make that evidence available and acceptable in the court in Austria, it must be gone through this big process. There's also what's known as the police channel, where there is no international law that says a policeman in Ireland can't pick up the phone and talk to a policeman in Austria and share information about a criminal over the phone, the same as a policeman in Dublin can do with a policeman in Carlow.
So that's what you do?
That's what we do, coordination.
Human trafficking, child exploitation, people, I think, often vary between imagining that it's a massive problem. On the other hand, some people say, is it a problem perhaps that's overblown, that makes sensational tabloid headlines? What's the actual reality from the point of view of international policing?
I could talk to you here about figures. I could start pulling figures out. I could talk to you about a website that went up online for 3 months in 2005 and 2006. It went up for 3 months, and in that 3 months had 7,000 people signing up to pay over $100 a head to get access to child abuse material. Or I could talk to you about the fact that we have 5,000-6,000 victims of child sexual abuse in a database in Lyon. You know, I could talk to you like that. I could talk to you about the fact that one in four girls and one in five boys will experience child sexual abuse before the age of 18 in Ireland and in any Western society. I could talk to you from a human trafficking perspective about the girls who are lured to Ireland to operate as prostitutes. I could talk to you about the girls who are lured from Indonesia and the Philippines to operate as house slaves here in Ireland. I could talk to you about young lads from all over Eastern Europe who come to Ireland to work in farms and in vegetable picking, for example, vegetable work, where they're not being paid, where there's gang masters. I could talk to you about the chocolate bar that you have with your pint of Guinness tonight in the bar in a pub, and how that was made from cocoa seeds that were most likely picked by children, cocoa plants that were most likely picked by children in West Africa. Right. So how your shirt might have been made from cotton that was picked by children, you know, they're not being paid.
So it's a problem with really a very broad scale.
It is, you know, and that's and of course you can separate human trafficking from child exploitation. I mean, child exploitation, especially around sexual exploitation. I mean, we all know, look at, in the last couple of years in this country and in most countries, you have this whole area of children and childhood and everything else is all that we're starting to understand childhood a little bit better. I mean, when we talk about having long summer holidays, is that because the teachers want to get off for a long summer? Well, you could argue that that's true too, but the teachers wouldn't be too impressed. But the reason we have long summer holidays is so children can go home and help on the farm, they can help with the planting in the spring holidays, they can help with the harvest in the autumn holidays. There's the realities of why of childhood, where, you know, children were seen as a legitimate source of labour up until a certain... I mean, we can talk about Dickens' London, where children were going up and down chimneys, and in the mills of the Industrial Revolution, where children had, with their nice hands, were very handy for getting in and fixing spools. So that's childhood, you know, even 50 years ago, wasn't thought of the same way we think of childhood nowadays. So where does child exploitation go in terms of where the way we understand it now? And, you know, we think about the Convention on the Rights of the Child, for example, in the UN, was only passed in 2001. You can see clearly that this is emerging now. And here in Ireland, and indeed in the US and in Belgium, where you had the church and the way the church might have handled, child sexual abuse a few years ago. We see it in England now with the... with the whole Jimmy Savile thing and the BBC getting dragged into it. Now we see there's a whole new inquiry going on as to how the state handled sexual abuse in the 70s and 80s. So you can see that we're becoming more and more aware of it. And the internet has a role to play in that. If we want to just segue across into where child exploitation and technology come together, is absolutely obvious when you think back years ago about child... What you'll hear me throughout this using the expression, just to clarify with you, I don't use the words child pornography anymore. Mm. Pornography implies that it's socially acceptable. Pornography implies that the actors within it are consenting to what's going on. Pornography implies that that there's, you know, it's okay to become sexually aroused by it. But when you're talking about the child pornography that we deal with in the police on a regular basis, you're talking about children, you know, 4-year-old, 5-year-old children being, you know, involved in full sex acts, full penetrative sex acts. And we can't use pornography for that. So really, we use the expression child abuse material, so CAM or child abuse material. So you'll be hearing me saying that. And when we go back to child abuse material and pornography involving children, you know, the fact that it was being produced in the, you know, in a legitimate way in the 70s, the late 60s and into the 70s, it was being produced in a legitimate way. Unfortunately, you know, the it was being produced in magazines and in 8mm movies and stuff like that at the time. And a lot of the countries where that was being produced, especially in Central and Northern Europe, they locked, in Western Europe and Northern Europe, they locked it down in the mid-80s and they said, no more, we don't want any more, you can't. This is child abuse you're filming here. This is not child pornography, because, of course, pornography itself is seen to be benign and is seen to be, you know, in our enlightened societies, it's seen, pornography is seen okay, it's seen as normal. Even adults, normal adults will admit to using pornography these days, where, you know, in our time, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, gee, you'd be horrified to imagine that someone would know you were using pornography, you know. So the internet has kind of taken a lot of that, and what was driven underground, you know, child abuse material was driven underground, the possession of it, the distribution of it was driven underground. The internet actually brought it all back. Very, very quickly. So much so that a lot of countries were caught without law for it, actually. Or, you know, while they might have had law, a good example would be the United Kingdom, for example. The United Kingdom had indecency legislation in relation to indecent images or indecent movies that they had in the 1970s or whatever. That was legislation that was dealing with what they had then and the small amount of child abuse material that they would be encountering on a daily basis. And of course they made the tie back, the very clear tie back, because oftentimes when you found child abuse material in those days, you found it in the possession of the person who made it, right? Or one step away from them, because these people had to meet physically to actually exchange this. It was very difficult to get it processed. So much so that people who were into child abuse material in those days had to learn how to develop pictures themselves, because they couldn't just hand in a roll of film of abusing a six-year-old boy that they had made themselves. They couldn't just hand that roll of film into the pharmacy and have it developed. They had to learn to do it themselves, which is a good example, actually, of, you know, we'd often say in those days, and even today, that people who have a sexual interest in children were very quick to pick up technology. So historically, we talk, when we see movies, for example, we see on YouTube, you can see back in the 80s, you had this, like the bulletin board systems, where you'd put the hook of your telephone onto the modem. I mean, in those days, one of the first groups, if you like, who realised the potential of being able to transfer files were the people with a pedophilic interest in children, because they could now exchange their movies or their pictures with each other very, very, well, quickly. And also, you know, they could, again, who would have been the first adapters of the use of movie cameras, or who were the VHS or Betamax, who were the first adapters of that? You'll find that they were people with a sexual interest in children, because of the sexual interest, it's needs driven, and therefore they would often revolve their whole lives around sex with children. We see that even today. We'll see that with people who relocate to live in the Philippines or Southeast Asia, in Thailand or Cambodia or Laos. They're doing that because over there they get access to children, whereas here they won't get the same access here. So we see that. That they're also, so with bulletin board systems, with digital cameras, they were the first to adopt them right to the very end. And we see online, unfortunately, we see it as well. They'll be the first to abuse any new system that comes on. So all of the new systems, new platforms that have been developed over the years, each one of them is suitably abused and exploited by these people to advocate with each other, to be in touch with each other, B, to exchange child abuse material, or child pornography as people know it as, to exchange the material, either new stuff that they're developing themselves or just exchanging other stuff that they have got sourced elsewhere. And the third way that they would use it is probably to actually gain access to children themselves. So you can see that those three ways, the internet serves those purposes.
And as you point out, there's a varying degree of protection legal protection for children in different jurisdictions, and some countries are better at it than others, some countries not so good at it. Again, the internet breaks down all these international boundaries, and it means that people can exploit children in one jurisdiction and make the product of that exploitation available worldwide through these networks.
Very good point. And it's one of the things we're seeing actually now emerging right now is what's called remote child sexual exploitation. So in your village in the Philippines, you have a reasonable internet connection, you speak a bit of English, and you have a camera, and you Bozo goes online and he pays his money to you through Western Union, and I'm not picking a Western Union, mm-hmm. through some online PayPal, whatever, any one of them, pays his money, and then you carry out sex acts for him online using his name, or perhaps doing stuff to order for him online. And you have kids as young as 6 and 7 in villages. So the potential for that type of exploitation is huge. But again, you can see that's emerging right now. So would you talk about this breaking down the boundaries? Of course, absolutely. We're seeing it more and more now. The more, you know, connectivity you have, the better, right? That's a standard way of thinking. Unfortunately, from my perspective, the more connectivity you have, the more abuse you'll have.
The availability and the opportunity of technology is actually driving a market for child sexual abuse.
Absolutely. I'd even go further. And I would suggest that the availability of technology is actually encouraging the abuse of children. Now people, you know, and I can stand it if people say, that's rubbish. But actually it is. You know, in my world, when I'm in there with these guys in these chat rooms, we can see very clearly that the currency of these chat rooms, these guys are not paying for this material. These guys are producing this material, they're swapping it like for like. So therefore it becomes the currency. And the person who's in the room who can show that they are actually producing it is king. Right? So if you are in these rooms and you are in these communities, well then it behoves you to be doing your best to be actually one of the people who's abusing and supplying new material, new movies, new images, new victims perhaps to the community, and therefore raising your own status. And that's a fact. And while I can't empirically prove it, I'm nothing but a simple policeman. I'm sure there's academics out there who can show that in the future. But I'm telling you right now that this type of activity, this type of connectivity, the ease with which we can make movies and pictures, and there's nothing we can do about this. This is human nature. Has increased, I've no doubt, has increased the sexual abuse of children.
But you must have thought, and you must think, obviously, in your role, Mick, and other police people around the world as well, short of shutting down the internet, short of taking away the technology, how can we police this? How can we, what action can we take? And I'm not just saying the police and the authorities, but I'm sure that people who are involved in the internet industry worldwide want to stamp this out as well. What can be done?
Absolutely. And I mean, there's no doubt that this is not a policing issue. This is a societal issue. How many people are there in the world who have a sexual interest in children? How do we deal with that? Do we accept it, or do we do the kind of tabloid version of it, or do we accept as a society and maturely move on and say yes, there are a certain number of people in our society who have a sexual interest in children. What are we going to do about it? Do we deal with them, and how do we deal with them? So there's all that aspect from a societal perspective. From a technology perspective, I think we go back to the old days and the fact that the internet is but a system, a network of networks, right? Now, if it's a network of networks, somebody's in charge of each of those networks. So who's responsible for this network? And are you, as a responsible person for that network, are you allowing your network to be used for abuse? If you are you being forced into dealing with that abuse? What are you doing to mitigate the risk that your system is being used for abuse? And I think... it would be fair to say that technology people have got their act together when it comes to their networks being used for abuse issues around spam, malware, hacking. All of these issues are being dealt with. Now, where it becomes an issue with child abuse material is the content aspects. That it's content, and therefore, as a network engineer, I don't have to worry about the content. I'm just putting the railway in place, and whoever, what's in the train, I don't know what's in the train. The train will run on my network. And that's fine. I understand those arguments. But those arguments also exist for malware. Those arguments also exist for spam. And these are elements that are doing harm to other people. And what I would love technology people to make the connection is that in order to have child abuse material, in order to have child pornography, you must have abused a child. Somebody must have abused a child. So there is harm involved in this material. Harm to the child who it was produced for. Harm to the child who it was produced by abusing. Harm to the child that it is used to subsequently groom. So if you're wanting a child to understand that it's okay to have sex with Uncle Peter, well, what better way than to show them pictures of another child the same age as them having sex with another man that looks like Uncle Peter? Harm to the people who may or may not have a sexual interest in children but end up with this material and end up getting in trouble with the law because of it. Lots and lots of reasons why child abuse material is something. Harm to your own company, to your own reputation, by having this material going out there on your IP address. All of these things, it's something that we're constantly trying to get technology people to realise, is that it is as harmful, if not, it is harmful, if not even worse, more harmful than some of the stuff that you're very quick to deal with, that you have standard operating procedures to deal with.
Is the awareness of the role of technology and internet companies, do you think it's as widespread as it needs to be? Are there more companies and more industry associations that need to perhaps do more in Ireland and in other jurisdictions around the world?
I think it's fair to say that a lot of the bigger organisations are getting onto it now. I mean, you have in the InHope network, for example, there's an organisation called InHope, InHope.org. And if you're wondering, if you're listening to this podcast in any country in the Western world, have a look on that, InHope.org, and you'll find the hotline in your country. I would recommend that you have a chat with them. Now, hotlines are organisations that are EU-funded. They're put in place there to deal with these issues on the open internet, so that members of the public can go to these hotlines. So hotline.ie would be the internet service providers of Ireland have put that in place. They would know how to deal with an incident like this. They would know how best to manage this type of incident within your company. They'll be able to advise you properly. Of course, there are consultancy companies out there that are well able to deal with these issues. But more importantly, I think, you know, the likes of First, the likes of, I don't know, what are they called, MOG, the likes of ICANN, these organisations are dealing with these issues. They're coming to deal with them more and more. They're starting to accept now that child abuse material is not pornography. And they're two very separate things. And Larry Flint, many years ago, established that in the United States of America, pornography enjoyed First Amendment protection. On the other hand, there has been Supreme Court law in relation to child abuse material or pornography involving children. It enjoys zero First Amendment protection. In actual fact, there are very strong and robust laws in all of the Western world to deal with it. And some of those laws, and this is what's important for companies to remember, some of those laws would include laws like the French non-assistance to person in danger law. So if you find on your system movies involving children, say a child of 6 or 7 years of age, clearly a child being sexually abused, are you falling foul of those laws if you don't help that child? Even though you don't know her name, even though you'd like to imagine that it's someplace else, the reality is it could be, statistically, it's actually closer to home than you think. And it could actually be the child or a neighbouring child of the person on whose computer you found this. And how do you know that it isn't? So you can try and imagine and like to imagine that it's happening someplace else, but actually it could be happening right there.
And home. As you point out, you should think that it's quite possible that you are the person, perhaps this is, you are the person who has had the very first opportunity to help that child.
You know, the vast majority, ironically, the availability of child abuse material gives us as humans the first opportunity ever that humanity has ever had to deal with child sexual abuse proactively. Because The vast majority of child sexual abuse takes place within the family home or within the immediate family circle. Now that's a statistical fact. 85% or 90% to 90% takes place within the family home or within the immediate family circle. So therefore, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. In fact, it's statistically very likely that if this person on whose computer you found this that works for you, and it could be your sales manager, it could be your CEO, it could be your fellow who cleans the backyard, that person, is very possible that that person is abusing a child because the very fact that they're possessing this material means that they have a sexual interest in children. If they have that sexual interest in children, are they carrying it out? Now that's a question you need to be asking yourself as the person responsible for this network that has found this stuff. Are they actually abusing a child, and are you the person with this stuff in your hand who can save that child from a lifetime of agony?
Mick, you've been working with Interpol for over 15, 16 years, I think you were saying to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, with Interpol about 8 years, but I'm working this game about 15 okay. or 16 years, yeah.
And it's would it be fair to ask you, I mean, are you, it's a difficult job, I imagine. Is it discouraging? Are you optimistic? Are you hopeful that that progress is being made and that certainly it's a job worth doing and you can help people? Do you ever get discouraged by the scale of the problem?
No, I don't. I haven't seen the plateau. I haven't seen the ceiling yet. So it's huge. It's bigger and bigger and bigger. It's getting. Do I get discouraged? No, I don't, because I'm also, while I'm not seeing a ceiling, I'm seeing the curtains being pulled back constantly on the next level, on the next level, on the next level. And I see law coming into place in countries. I see initiatives like the Global Alliance. People who wouldn't be in this game probably wouldn't have heard of the EU-US Global Alliance Against Child Pornography. You have the EU directive there in 2011, which insisted that all European countries have the same law, harmonised procedures. And in that, it talks about victim identification and victim-centric. You see, one of the biggest problems that we've seen over the years is policing as well. Police are not great with victims. Everyone knows that. They're great at feeling a fella's collar, you know. We'll catch that fella by the ear and we'll lock him up. Yes, brilliant. But what about the victim, you see? So this victim-centric way of thinking, there's three things that a police officer can do in relation to this. You can do a fella for possession of it. You can do of child abuse material. You can do a fella for distribution of it. But more importantly is the pillar where you investigate, where did this material come from? And is there some way we can identify this child? So all that thinking, getting police thinking around the victims and victim-centric thinking, all of that type of stuff is mighty. It's improving all the time. And so discouraged? No. No. Discouraged is not a way I would say it. Unfortunately, I'll never be laid off. Now, that's the only thing I can say. And so I spend a lot of my time training the next generation of officers, investigators coming through who are taking up the cudgel and moving forward with it. I've been promoted a couple of times. I've moved into management, so I'm no longer hands-on, but I'm happy to say that, you know, that we're getting new officers more passionate all every time, every year, new officers coming through. There's increased resources in countries going to this issue, and we're dealing with it very, very... And the funny thing is that if you combine the technologists, you combine your systems administrators with your online platform people, your law enforcement, and perhaps, you know, some civil society, non-governmental groups. If you combine those three or four together, this issue can be very easily and quickly dealt with. That's a reality. And so perhaps this podcast to technology.ie listeners is, look, play your part, please, and we'll deal with this issue really easily.
Well, Mick, thanks for talking to us. You're home for a few days here in Ireland.
Home with the family just for a couple of days, and bring them back. And my kids, it's very important that I bring them back from France, make sure they know that they're Irish. You
absolutely.
Know? Yeah, once in a while.
Well, thanks for talking to us.